Zone is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amati Nirmin-Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
It is coming up on 5 o'clock. Tune in to KBOO Portland. Up next, Cable Evening News.
We are women recently released from Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, where we were in a program called the Family Preservation Project, which helped our children stay connected to us and taught us how to parent.
The Department of Correction chose to cancel the Family Preservation Project. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear how you can help us flip the switch on DOC's decision. Please support Senate Bill 939, which addresses the needs of children with incarcerated moms.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 22nd at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Exposed explains how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Exposed, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two NASA studies released this week draw a predictable but grim conclusion. The Earth is running out of fresh water.
The Oregonian is participating in a testing program that will allow journalists to use drones for news collection.
And the U.S. government's new rules on net neutrality just went into effect last Friday and are already the subject of a lawsuit.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 17th, 2015. I'm Jennifer Kemp.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Portland City Council heard testimony from city residents today regarding the ongoing Vision Zero safety initiative. We'll hear from, in order, Terry Parker, Corey Poole of the Northwest Skate Coalition, Noel Mickleberry, Executive Director of Oregon Walks, and Roger Averbach from the Portland Pedestrian Advisory Committee.
My name is Terry Parker, and I'm wearing my own hat today. Vision Zero must include bicycle stings and a strict enforcement of traffic laws as it applies to bicycling, and the enforcement must include consequences such as heavy fines. The current double standard, slap on the wrist and look the other way bicycling enforcement, just cultivates more mayhem. Bicycling speeds also need to be reduced. Adult bicycling needs to be banned on all city sidewalks. Additionally, bicyclists need to walk their bikes in crosswalks when the crossing is not part of a bicycle trail. The all-too-often, on-again, off-again, bypassing a traffic control device by riding on the sidewalk or hastily using a crosswalk is a crash looking for a place to happen. Motorist representation and participation has been excluded from the process, while bicyclists have a huge I-want list. This list includes adding bike lanes and specialized bicycle infrastructure, buffered bike lanes, and restricting motor vehicle access to bikeways on green streets. Equity requires that bicyclists must start accepting the financial responsibility for all that specialized space, funded through bicycle paid user and license fees, and not by siphoning off and rating motorist paid gas taxes.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Corey Poole. I'm here today representing the Northwest Skate Coalition in support of Vision Zero. As you all well know, and we've heard today, we're experiencing a troubling increase in vehicular accidents involving people walking and riding bicycles. I hear from too many Portlanders that they don't feel comfortable riding their bicycles or skateboards on city streets due to the quantity and aggressive behavior of motorists in their neighborhoods. People will not let their children walk to school for fear of dangerous road crossings near their homes on the way to school. The resolution that's under consideration today gives me hope, but we all need to give this urgent crisis the immediate attention it deserves. The Northwest Skate Coalition today is joining the broader coalition of pedestrian and bicycle organizations, calling on you to adopt the date of 2025 as a deadline for Portland to achieve Vision Zero. And I hope we can include that into the language soon. As you well know, every Portlander deserves safe and legal access to active transportation, and I look forward to your support.
My name is Noelle Mickleberry, and I'm the executive director of Oregon Walks, pedestrian advocacy organization. This weekend, I was riding my bike and walking through Mount Tabor Park to celebrate my anniversary with my partner when I got the call about two pedestrians that were hit on the Burnside Bridge. I spent the rest of the day with a clenched chest thinking about what might have happened if we had been in a different place at a different time. And knowing that a family was getting a phone call, confirming that reality. And this is going to continue to happen as long as we have the streets that allow for it. When a person driving a two-ton vehicle going at speeds that are almost guaranteed to kill someone, this isn't the same kind of mistake that happens when you forget your keys at home. No one should accept this as an okay consequence of getting from here to there. This is not something that should turn a sunny afternoon on a beautiful bridge into a crime scene, a memorial site, a place where we can only remember what could have happened. I want the city to adopt Vision Zero, and I want to see it with a date to reach that goal. We need political will to invest in the things that we know make our streets safe. We know that Burnside, with curb-tight sidewalks, high speeds, and wide lanes, is not a safe place. That's really not a surprise to anyone that something bad happened here. What can we do to be proactive and be proactive fast to stop this from happening? People traveling through the city don't think about what jurisdiction they happen to be in when they're walking, biking, or driving. They want to see the same safe infrastructure that allows them to access their community that they live, work, and play in everywhere. And they don't want to see politics as usual. They want to see collaboration. There have now been 3 deaths in less than a month, 2 since the mayor announced his public commitment to Vision Zero. The sad thing is that this isn't new. This is happening across the city all the time. We need to continue the urgency.
My name is Roger Averbeck. As a volunteer, I serve as co-chair of Portland's Pedestrian Advisory Committee. However, my comments today are my own, in part because although our committee is aware of this effort and we support it, we haven't been invited to participate yet. On to my comments. We live in a permissive society, and we really depend on others to respect and follow a lot of complicated and not well understood rules intended to keep us from harming each other. And this is obviously not working well in the realm of public roadways. The problem is worsened by the imbalance of power created by motor vehicles. They're out there in greater numbers, and they have a false sense of superiority, and the consequences are obvious, that they not following the rules can be severe or fatal for more vulnerable cyclists or pedestrians. Everybody, pedestrians, cyclists, drivers, advocates, law enforcement, planners, engineers, and decision makers, that's you, need to raise their level of personal responsibility and take part in the solutions. Portland needs an immediate increase in funding for and a higher priority on traffic enforcement, especially on our high crash corridors. Motor vehicle drivers have the advantage. The arterials are designed for them. They must take greater responsibility to not injure and kill vulnerable road users who have the right to share and safely cross these public facilities.
Those were excerpts from today's testimony before City Council regarding the Vision Zero initiative. intended to eliminate traffic fatalities on Portland streets. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with PBOT's Dylan Rivera about some of the facts regarding funding for Portland city streets and efforts to increase safety for all road users. Mr. Rivera requested that we direct listeners to the website visionzeroportland.com. Mr. Rivera also provided some insight into the funding mechanisms and expenditures of PBOT in regard to bicycle infrastructure. According to Mr. Rivera, the city's typical yearly discretionary spending for bicycle infrastructure is in the range of $150,000. This represents 0.045% of PBOT's budget. Other bicycling infrastructure improvements commonly come as a part of multimodal upgrades and are often funded through federal grants. While the gas tax, in its many forms, represents a significant part of PBOT's funding, services to auto users represent the vast majority of PBOT spending. Other sources of PBOT funding include the Portland General Fund, system development charges, and other city agencies. Again, that website is visionzeroportland.com.
A Portland bicyclist has sued the city of Portland over allegations of neglect concerning safety on Portland streets. Michael Cooley was riding on North Interstate on June 15, 2015, at approximately 11:30 p.m. after leaving his shift as a postal driver. According to Cooley's wife, he was wearing two reflective vests and had five lights on his bike when he was struck by a pickup driver near Greeley Avenue. Cooley suffered a spine broken in 11 places, paralysis, a lacerated liver, and internal bleeding, among other serious injuries. The driver left the scene before police could arrive. The stretch of Interstate Avenue has been the site of at least one cyclist death and nine other serious crashes since the completion of the Max Yellow Line. The MATS project is seen as the main reason that the bike lane in question is, as Cooley's lawsuit maintains, too narrow. An Oregon administrative rule states that 6-foot bike lanes are the standard, but allows for 4-foot wide lanes where physical factors make wider lanes impossible. Cooley's lawsuit is rare, as most crashes are seen as being due to human error. Cooley seeks $21.4 million in damages.
City workers and supporters held a rally in downtown Portland today for good jobs and a fair minimum wage. The rally was part of the Fight for 15 movement and marks one of the many nationwide actions that took place this week as part of the Justice for Janitors campaign. KBOO's Jekka Soderberg has more.
Around 100 workers took off from City Hall at noon today with a consensus to take over the street as they marched to Szymanski Park. The workers filled 4th Avenue and began chanting, "What do we want? 15. When do we want it? Now." The workers chanted, "What's outrageous? Poverty wages," as they rounded the bend from 4th Avenue onto Washington Street and onto Szymanski Park. The demand for a $15 minimum wage follows the announcement earlier this week by Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek that she'll be reviving a bill to raise the minimum wage in Oregon to $13 an hour by 2018. Here's some of the rally that took place today. Szymanski Park.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Finn, and I am a grocery worker, a UFCW 555 member. And I want to tell you something. We just got our first raise of 25 cents an hour after 2 years with no raise, while our CEO makes $49,000 a day. $49,000 a day, and we got a 25 cent an hour raise because we need 15 now. We need a living wage and we need full-time jobs, not this part-time job stuff that Fred Meyer and the grocery stores have. So let's fight together for 15 and full-time jobs.
Rosario works as a janitor in Portland. She talked about how important the increase in the minimum wage is for herself and other janitors.
Our work is heavy job, so it's really bad the job we have it, so we needed a little more money. It's not enough money for support all our family. Oh, I am cleaning office sometimes, I'm restroom right now, and I work in 8 hours. Chief, so something that is physical, so it's hard. So that is why we try to, we want it, more money, $15. And that is, I think so, that is good for everybody, not only for the unions or something. I think so, for all the community, it's good.
Some of the other workers who are currently struggling for an increase in the minimum wage are seasonal park employees in the city of Portland and home care workers who help elderly and disabled people throughout Oregon.
We are seeing how all these home care workers, they are living with wages on $9.75, $10.25. They are overworked. They ask them to work like sometimes double shift without any break. So this is a great way to start something for the home care workers. So the home care workers who take care of our loved ones shouldn't be respected and not treated as machinery that they can be disposed when they are no longer able to work. Right now the campaign is with all the home care workers, whatever they are, like group home care workers, child care, you know, all the facilities. We want that all the healthcare workers come together and be united, you know, that they create their own union and be fighting for all the needs that they have.
I'm Erica Askin from Laborers Local 483 in Portland, Oregon. We represent the seasonal maintenance workers and the parks technicians in the city of Portland, and they have fair wages and benefits. The seasonal maintenance workers, though, you know, actually, we don't believe that they're seasonal either. We think it's a misnomer. It's a bad title for the work that they do. A lot of them also work year-round, and we are organizing and we're bargaining for fairness and wages and benefits for them, too.
Jack Mossberg is a retired Catholic chaplain who also participated in the rally today.
It should probably be higher, first of all. It should probably be like 20. And the other part of it is that people can't live on what we now have as a minimum wage. It's just not realistic. You can't, you have no future. You know, there's no livability to this minimum wage. And that, can you raise a family? Can you have some security for the future? Can you raise your kids with the hope of them going to college or something? You can't do it on a minimum wage. 15, maybe. You're at the edge, but still, 15 is not enough. So it's really important that the workers have enough so that they can live a life that with some security and some real livability. You know, and that they can have a family, and some hope for the future. Because with minimum wage, there's not much hope. I mean, you're not going anyplace with that.
After rallying at Chemehuevski Park, the workers took over the streets of downtown Portland. Cars honked in support, and workers at downtown stores looked out of their windows and voiced their support. The city council has not introduced a measure that would increase the minimum wage in the city. They are prevented from doing so by a law at the state level. Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the Oregon House, says she plans to reintroduce a bill this week to increase the minimum wage to $13 an hour. The movement 15 Now PDX has voiced support for Kotek's measure, as well as for recent legislative victories around Ban the Box, retirement security, ending racial profiling, and improving paid sick time for all Oregonians. More information can be found on their website, 15nowpdx.org. That's the number 15nowpdx.org. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
Mike Abbott, Portland's park director, was recently given a raise over $15,000. Commissioner Amanda Fritz granted the 9% raise after previously calling such an increase, quote, unrealistic. A 9% raise is nearly twice the amount given for a standard merit-based raise. According to the Oregonian, Fritz was eventually swayed by Abbott's performance, including his approval for a $68 million parks bond. Abbott's salary is now over $180,000 a year. Park officials say that the parks department will likely fall $650,000 short of the expected revenues coming this year.
Over the weekend, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti signed that city's new minimum wage law. It'll push a worker's hourly wage to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. Now, LA County is thinking about an identical pay hike for workers in unincorporated areas. For more, we go to the California Report.
A few days after Los Angeles officially raised its minimum wage to $15 an hour over the next 5 years, LA County is considering an identical pay hike for workers in unincorporated areas. That's about 390,000 people. Supervisor Sheila Kuehl introduced the measure yesterday.
The fact that many county residents, despite working full-time, earn too little in wages to cover even their bare necessities, such as safe housing, healthy food, adequate clothing, and basic medical care, is intolerable in a county that values equity and fair reward.
The supervisors start debating that next week.
For the California Report, I'm April Domboski.
And that's the California Report for Wednesday, June 17th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Queenie Kim.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Flight attendants picketed Tuesday in several U.S. cities in a Bridge the Gap campaign to equalize wages and benefits between mainline and regional flights. AFA-CWA President Sarah Nelson.
In every single case across the board, flight attendants working at these regional airlines are paid on average 45% less than the flight attendants at the mainline carriers, while providing 45% of the lift of aircraft that's feeding those mainline flights. Many times they're flying on the exact same route as mainline carriers.
Nelson says workers in other industries also face company creation of second-class tiers of workers with one goal: to undermine wages and benefits. And she says the AFA-CWA Bridge the Gap campaign is in solidarity with other efforts to raise worker wages.
Bridge the Gap relates directly to the fight for 15. It relates directly to what's happening in this country, that there is an awakening, that we should have equal pay for equal work, that we should be recognized for the work that we do, respected for the work that we do, and be compensated for that. So we're out there to bridge the gap for flight attendants, but we're also out there spreading the message that we need to bridge the gap in this country between those who have and those who have not.
The main thing that GE appears to be indicating is they want more out of us in terms of medical cost sharing, even though 4 years ago they shifted billions of dollars over to us with a new medical plan where we're paying very high deductibles, high co-payments.
UE Local 201 business agent Rick Casilli, General Electric, and unions representing 16,500 workers are at the negotiating table now working on a new labor contract. Despite having made $16 billion in profits in 2014, GE wants more concessions from its workers, both union and non-union salaried workers.
GE made their industrial divisions over $16 billion in profit in 2014. Part of that rise is due to what they already shifted on us 4 years ago in medical costs. With what they just did to their salaried members, they're going to get $1.4 billion off the books in future benefit obligations to retirees. If they do it to us, you're talking anywhere in the range between $5 billion and $7 billion.
GE is also trying to complete the sale of its appliances division to the Swedish company AB Electrolux in a $3.3 billion deal, raising other important issues at the labor bargaining table. The White House and GOP House Speaker Boehner backed off efforts to have a revote that would send the TPP fast-track bill to Obama's desk. Boehner instead imposed a rule allowing him to call a revote on the issue at any time by July 30th. They don't have the votes because a labor-led coalition against TPP fast-track has so far stopped it in its tracks. WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the United Auto Workers Union and from the International Association of Machinists. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with, well, we'll be with Mike Crenshaw this evening. After that, it'll be Occupy Portland Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be partly cloudy with a high of 81 and winds around 10 miles an hour, moving to scattered clouds and 56 tomorrow night. Today in history, in 1462, forces led by Vlad III of Wallachia, also known as Vlad the Impaler or the Inspiration for Dracula, attacked an Ottoman camp at night in an attempt to assassinate Mehmet II. Our quote of the day comes from Jerome K. Jerome, who said, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours."
5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Great news! Walmart is investing in American jobs. It says so right here in a colorful, full-page ad showing a very happy Walmart worker displaying more than a dozen brand-name products made in the good old USA. The ad even gives a website, madewithamericanjobs.com, and says we can learn more by checking it out. So, I did. Yikes! The website is filled with stuff not made in America. In the special tips and ideas section touting gifts for Father's Day, Walmart promotes smartphones, none made in the U.S., flat-screen TVs, made in Korea, Japan, China, etc., and other foreign-made electronic gadgets that, quote, will leave Dad happy. Other sections of the web store offer a Taiwan computer, T-shirts from Fruit of the Loom, which closed its last U.S. plant in 2014, and an imported tent bearing Walmart's own house brand. In fact, out of some 5 million products available for online purchase from Walmart, less than 5,000, one-half of 1%, are U.S. made. 2 years ago, when Walmart's CEO announced the dazzling Made with American Jobs campaign, he pledged to create 1 million new jobs for American workers. Apparently, most of those are to be in advertising firms and PR agencies hired to hype the corporation's attempt to bamboozle us into thinking there's some substance to the promise to invest in America. For example, one PR promotion touted a towel maker in Georgia as a beneficiary of the retailer's new initiative. But the company actually added a mere 35 jobs and was keeping 90% of its production overseas. This is Jim Hightower saying, so far, Walmart's highly ballyhooed USA campaign has produced only about 2,000 of the 1 million jobs promised. The ad campaign expresses a nice sentiment, but where's the commitment?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
An Oregon legislative committee today heard testimony about a bill to provide services for parents who are imprisoned by the state. HB 3503 would provide some funding to help parents during and after their incarceration and would provide for alternatives to prison for some nonviolent offenders with children. The Family Preservation Project, which allowed mothers imprisoned at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility to have longer contact visits with their children, was cut from the state budget last year. Elizabeth Kushwa of Children First for Oregon spoke in favor of the bill.
Over 75% of the women in prison are parents. Over 7,500 parents in the general DOC population. In 2013, nearly 500 children, foster children, had an incarcerated parent. We really appreciate having a children's perspective into this bill, not just the offenders and the treatment places. We understand the importance of intensive intervention into families, including parenting classes and other partnerships. There is national data, the Nurse Family Partnership, I'm sure you may have heard of, did a study through home visiting. And the parents who went through home visiting, the women who went through home visiting, were twice less likely to have another felony conviction. But I think more important for the purposes of our state and this committee, their daughters were 9 times less likely to have a felony conviction by the age of 19. Mm. That is long-term systemic change and worth the investment that you will make in this program this day. We also appreciate the fact that this is going to give you an opportunity to quantify the programs that are out there. Maybe there will be tweaks at the end of a year or two. That's an important thing we need to know, so that we're keeping the children safe and the parents on the right track. I would also add to Children First support of this bill that the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, who is, I think you've all met the foster kids, they're youth-led, just voted on their legislative committee, and I believe you may have their testimony now, also to support this bill as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for listening to the kids.
You know, we've talked, at least Representative Williamson and I, about this bill complementing 939, which was be kind of the restartup of the Family Preservation Project, and then hopefully we will also fund more children's programs at DOC, perhaps in the next biennium with the policy option package, should DOC come forward with one. But I think, you know, we have an obligation to walk and chew gum at the same time, that we not just divert people, but we also, for the mothers who are going to have to be incarcerated, that we do the best we can to tie their kids to them while they're there and make sure that when moms come out, they hit the ground running on day one and are competent and ready to parent. So,
For the record, my name is Chris Edmonds, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Human Services. I don't want to belabor the point because you've heard a lot of good testimony already on this bill. But I think that it's worth noting that a little bit less than 2 years ago, I had coffee with Representative Williamson, and she said, "Hey, what do you know about kids who end up in the foster system because they have a parent who's incarcerated?" And I said, "That's a really good question." So I'm really pleased, very proud to be sitting at this table right now, testifying in support of this legislation. The Department of Human Services wholeheartedly supports HB 3503. This is a positive piece of legislation, and it represents forward-thinking, a collaborative approach to strengthening and preserving family bonds that are so critical to child development. We find that the trauma experienced by a child when they lose their primary caretaker is significant and can follow a child for life. What this legislation does is it allows parents who are capable to continue to safely parent their children while taking responsibility and being accountable for their criminal activity. HB 3503 represents another tool that child welfare has to access that we can access to equitably and safely reduce the number of children in foster care. So again, I'd like to recognize Representative Williamson and I believe the other 36 co-sponsors of this legislation for bringing this bill before you today. It's very innovative. It's an approach that has worked in Washington, and I would urge you to support it.
I have a question.
Senator Winters.
Will DHS have, and I'm going to go back to the professional staff and that staff that's capable, assigned to actually be a part of this?
So the plan as it stands today is that this bill would appropriate a single position in DHS field services that would be responsible for coordinating a statewide implementation of this bill. That person would be in charge of program design internally, as well as coordinating between the Department of Corrections and the community corrections departments on policies, procedures, and processes around this program. What we would anticipate is that this bill would leverage existing services through strengthening, preserving, reunifying families.
I raise that question because a critical component is in this is to make certain that the casework level does the casework's job in meeting the needs that's going on the other side. So when we talk about a level of service, I just want to make certain that that exists.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, absolutely. That's a critical component of this program, and your point is well taken. Our expectation would be that this bill will increase the communication and coordination between DHS, the family, and the corrections agency, so that way we're avoiding redundancies in service delivery. We're aligning our service delivery for the family in a way that's going to create successful outcomes on both the criminal and human services side of their involvement with the state of Oregon.
That was a representative from the Department of Human Services in Oregon responding to a question from Senator Winters. That exchange occurred during today's committee hearing on a bill that would provide funding for a program to help incarcerated parents in Oregon. The hearing will continue through tomorrow, when the committee decides whether to send it to the full Oregon House for a vote, amend the bill, or to drop it.
Several groups petitioned garden retailers across the country to stop selling pesticides that are toxic to bees. The petitions are focused on neonicotinoids, a leading driver of global bee population declines. Ace Hardware, one of the retailers targeted, announced at the beginning of the month that they are willing to phase out pesticides that are lethal to bees. The other 100 retailers petitioned have made no action toward eliminating these pesticides. This campaign is an observation of National Pollinator Week and is the most recent push to help mitigate the global bee decline crisis.
Privacy advocates renewed their protest of the tech industry using facial recognition technology. This technology, according to privacy advocates, is used without the consumer's consent and on a massive scale. Alvaro Bedoya, executive director of the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law School, said in a statement that the tech industry lobbyists are, quote, choking off Washington's ability to protect consumer privacy. Privacy groups have united in an effort to dilute the power of the tech industry's lobbyists and empower Washington to regulate the use of facial recognition technology.
The Oregonian is participating in a testing program that will allow journalists to use drones for news collection. This is an FAA-sanctioned program that includes 15 news media companies. Drones are currently only allowed to be flown by certified pilots. This program seeks to certify journalists to use drones for research and reporting purposes. The result of the program will be reviewed by the Federal Aviation Administration.
The U.S. government's new rules on net neutrality just went into effect last Friday and are already being invoked. A company called Commercial Network Services is accusing Time Warner Cable of charging them unreasonable rates to deliver their streaming videos to customers. Commercial Network Services runs several live webcams, including a webcast of one of the largest 4th of July fireworks displays on the West Coast.
A vulnerability in Samsung's Android keyboard could allow hackers to gain near full access to the device. The problem was discovered last December by a security company called NowSecure. NowSecure told Samsung about the security hole and was told in return to keep it quiet until Samsung could patch it. Now, 6 months later, it is unclear as to whether that patch has been completed, since Samsung must depend on wireless service providers to release the update containing the patch.
Two NASA studies released this week draw a predictable yet grim conclusion. The Earth is running out of fresh water. According to the reports, more than half of groundwater aquifers are being depleted of water faster than they are naturally replenished. Nearly 2 billion people rely on groundwater as their primary source of fresh water, especially in drought-prone areas. With global climate change and increasing human demand, the water table is dropping across the planet, and, as Jay Farmiglietti, senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, stated, there's not an infinite supply of water.
Palestinians reject the finding of an Israeli probe into the last Israeli war on Gaza. The findings, released just ahead of a forthcoming UN report on Israel's 2014 Operation Protective Edge against Hamas in Gaza, call Israeli army actions both lawful and legitimate. This is despite the fact that more than 2,000 Palestinians, a majority of them civilians, were killed during Israeli airstrikes and ground attacks. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Mohammed Tawfiq Iqdeh's relatives from the rural southern Gaza town of Khuza'a insist that the 63-year-old patriarch of their family was killed in cold blood by Israeli soldiers in the summer of 2014 during a ground invasion into their neighborhood. 2 months ago, with the help of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, as part of the probe, they submitted affidavits to Israeli army officials at the Eretz border crossing north of Gaza. Ramadan Kudeh is one of Muhammad's sons.
They asked one main question. Did the victim speak to the soldiers? And I answered by saying that as he left our basement, he told them, I hold a Spanish passport and I am elderly, and now I have women and children in the basement. And as you see, I am carrying a white flag. Once he finished speaking to the soldiers, they shot him dead, right in the heart.
In the report released Sunday, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Justice, with input from the military establishment, admitted that Palestinian civilians were caught up in the fighting. But according to the report, the Israeli army did not intentionally target civilians. Hassan Abdu is a Gaza-based political analyst. Abdu dismisses the report, saying that the international community's inaction towards justice in the occupied Palestinian territories fails to hold Israel accountable anyway.
Even Goldstone's report of 2009, which was based on meetings by Richard Goldstone himself with many of the victims in Gaza then, was not taken into consideration. No one dared to punish Israel based on that report, despite the fact that the report was commissioned by the United Nations itself.
The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah also rejects the Israeli probe's findings and says it will only accept an international investigation into possible Israeli war crimes committed in Gaza in 2014. 4 months after the 2014's Israeli war on Gaza, Israel blocked a UN fact-finding mission from entering the occupied coastal territory. The United Nations Human Rights Council is expected to release its report on hostilities any day now. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 17th, 2015. Israeli soldiers invade West Bank communities, kidnap civilians, and demolish a home in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped early on Wednesday at least 7 Palestinians in various parts of the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem in numerous invasions targeting different communities. Media sources in Bethlehem have reported that several army vehicles invaded Taqwa town east of Bethlehem and kidnapped one man after searching his home. Moreover, soldiers stormed homes in Silwad town east of the central West Bank city of Ramallah and kidnapped 3 Palestinians, including a child, after searching their homes. Shortly after midnight, soldiers invaded Bil'in town near Ramallah and kidnapped one man. In Jerusalem, soldiers invaded Al-Izariya town southwest of the city and kidnapped a young man. Early on Wednesday at dawn, soldiers invaded Beit Umar and Yatta towns in the southern West Bank district of Hebron, searched homes and kidnapped a child. On Tuesday night, several Israeli military vehicles kidnapped one Palestinian from the Askar refugee camp and another in Beita town near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Also on Tuesday at night, Israeli soldiers invaded Silwan town in occupied East Jerusalem, clashed with dozens of local youth, wounding 5, and kidnapped one child. Soldiers also fired gas bombs at homes and cars. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan has reported that the soldiers fired rubber-coated metal bullets, mildly wounding 5 Palestinians. In other news, Israeli soldiers invaded Wednesday Beit Hanina neighborhood north of occupied Jerusalem and demolished a Palestinian home. The demolished property, located in Al-Marwaha area in Beit Hanina, belongs to Tamer Idris. Idris said that the soldiers invaded his home after surrounding the area and only allowed the family to remove some of its property, leaving the rest behind. He added that the city council bulldozers, accompanied by the army, demolished his property and informed him they have placed a destruction order near his property 2 days ago. The resident said he never received the alleged order, otherwise he would have filed an appeal instantly. The army claims his property was built without construction permit. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 17th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Jory Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Catherine Matichuk and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm KBU.org/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KBU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-832-4120. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River 91.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Kemp.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9 o'clock, Per Fogring hosts a special hour-long call-in version of Fight the Empire on The Great Game. He asks, can today's wars and terrorist outrages be related to an age-old conflict? At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with author James Anderson, founder of Bright and Bush Books, about his debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Andrew Geller speaks with veteran environmental journalist and author Fred Pierce, whose latest title is The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.